This is Peter Rosenberger, and one of the reasons I wrote my new book, A Minute for Caregivers, is because I remember the sinking, despairing feeling of struggling as a caregiver. No one knew what to say to me. I didn't understand, and others didn't understand me. For decades, I foraged along and tried to find my path through this medical nightmare that Gracie and I have endured for nearly 40 years. And I've learned to speak the language of caregivers. I speak fluent caregiver. No pastor, no counselor, no medical provider, no friend should ever throw their hands up and say, I don't know what to say to that caregiver. Because I do. Give them a copy of this book. It's called A Minute for Caregivers, When Every Day Feels Like Monday. They're easy to read, 1-minute chapters that speak directly to the heart of a caregiver, and you can get them wherever books are sold. A Minute for Caregivers, When Every Day Feels Like Monday. Friends, don't let friends caregive alone. Oh, I love that voice. That is my wife, Gracie, and I love her singing that song. I wrote that song many, many years ago, and I love hearing her sing it. Thank you for your indulgence on that. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver. HopeForTheCaregiver.com. Healthy caregivers make better caregivers. I am joined today by a very special guest. I've been actually wanting to have him on for quite some time, and he has been gracious to work with our crazy schedule this fall. And this is Edward Grennan. He is the editor-in-chief of Guidepost Magazine. I've had the opportunity to write for Guidepost in various forums, most recently in their Strength and Grace magazine that they have. And he's got a new book out called A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. And it is a deeply moving book, and I'm excited to have him talk about this. So, Edward, welcome to the program. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, Peter. I'm very happy to be here. And you mentioned crazy schedules, and you know something? I don't know anyone who doesn't have a crazy schedule, particularly in the fall. But so it's a pleasure that we're able to work these things out, and we can finally get to talk. I've been anxious to speak with you, especially about the subject of caregiving, which is it is so prevalent in our country. I mean, we are, in a way, a nation of caregivers. In one form or another, we're giving care, and if we're not giving it, we're receiving care. And sometimes it's both. So caregiving is a burden of love. And even though the circumstances that may call for caregiving are difficult, so often brings us together. It makes us aware of the power of empathy and giving of ourselves. It's not easy. As you know, caregiving can be tremendously stressful and difficult.
That's why I look the way I look, Edward.
I think you look pretty good.
Don't let this happen to somebody you love. For many years, of course, Guidepost is a staple in our country and around the world. And for many years, we received it. Gracie's grandmother was a huge subscriber for many years, and I read it. And then I started noticing a change over the years, most recent years with you guys, and I started noticing more conversations about the caregiver world. And I was intrigued by that. And I actually, like I said, I wrote a few things with you guys, but I didn't know your story. And now I know why, as the editor in chief. And you, how long have you been there?
Well, I showed up in 1986, if you can believe that. I was jobless, penniless, almost homeless, and struggling to find recovery from drugs and alcohol. I don't know why Guidepost hired me. I wouldn't have hired me with my background. And I didn't know what Guidepost was. When I got the call, I thought it was a travel magazine. So I thought, maybe I'll get some trips out of this job. So I went in for the interview, and I liked the people, and I read the magazine, and it was really intriguing. And I said, I'll stay for a year. And that was in 1986. And I have been there ever since. I became editor in chief in 1999 and have been so ever since. If you change the title from a travel magazine to change that word travel to journey, it has been my spiritual journey to be involved in this magazine and in this audience that supports the magazine, who tells the people who tell their stories of faith and action in everyday living, lifted me up, and it's really it put me on the road of recovery and to spiritual growth. And it's a journey that I wake up every morning and thank God for.
I think it's marvelous what you've done, and I've, like I said, I've been tracking the changes, and now I recognize that is that's been your handprint on this, and ultimately God's handprint on moving so many of the stories into the caregiving world to recognize that we got over 65 million caregivers in this country. Also, you started at Guidepost the same year I became a caregiver in 1986. I was also struck by quite a few things in your journey. I mean, this was a part of your life before your mother's Alzheimer's. You had a brother with Down syndrome. And so these are not new things to you.
No, and with my brother Bobby, who had Down syndrome and who was just a few years older than me, I was the youngest. And that so much revolves around that child, and necessarily importantly. So I remember, I'll tell you this one little story about my parents, who were just the most devout Catholics, and they were church going, believing Catholics, and they really trusted the church. And after Bobby was born, and they knew that he had Down syndrome right away, and they told my parents, and my parents brought Bobby home, and the some priests came to the house, and they sat my parents down, and they said, we have orders of nuns whose ministry is to care for these children, and if you like, we will take Bobby, and we will raise him and care for him and give him all the love he needs. And it was the closest I ever saw my mother slap a priest, because she said, she said, nobody is going to take care of this child but us, and we will do it better than anybody else could ever possibly do it with God's help and God's love. And that's what they did.
Well, from what I could tell about your mother's personality that you so beautifully recounted in this book, I can imagine she darn near came off her seat and lunged at the priest. She was not a timid woman.
No, but it's the only time I ever saw her like argue with a clergy member, because that was not in her character. She was a strong-willed woman. She was very bright. She was raised by a school teacher. Her mother was a school teacher, and learned how to read before she even went to school. She was way ahead of her class and skipped grades. Eventually, she was in the 1950s, as a young married woman, she was a quiz show champion on television. She was really sharp and really fast. So when that time came years later, when she began to develop symptoms of what would be diagnosed as dementia, and eventually she did die of Alzheimer's, it was, we were in denial, and it wasn't that we just were in denial that this strong, bright, vibrant woman was suddenly slipping in a way that not only we didn't understand, but we couldn't stop. And that took us a while to get past that denial, because we kept trying to say, oh, it's just the normal vagaries of an aging brain. So she forgets to turn the stove off, or she forgets what she wanted to pick up at the store and has to go back three times. We tried to rationalize all that, but it got to the point when the needs for her caregiving needs became too obvious to us, that we had to do something, and we had to start doing things for her that she always had done for herself. And she didn't like it either.
In the book, you recounted the story at church where she couldn't do some of the library functions, the deposits, and things such as that. And that must have been incredibly heartbreaking for her.
It was when I heard I was living in New York, and this is, we can get to this later, but I had to do a lot of caregiving from a distance and felt very, very guilty about that, because I was in New York working. And my brother and sister-in-law and sister were really the ones on scene to take care of mom and really saw her daily. Yeah, you're right. That firsthand was, one of the things my mother always did to help out at church every day was to count the collection basket after morning mass. And then she would fill out a deposit slip and take it to the bank. She'd done it for years. And it made her feel very much a part of worship and a way to help the pastor. And Sister Carolyn, who was my mother's confidant at the time, called us one day and said, "Look, your mother is not counting the collection basket correctly and goes to the bank and everything's wrong. So we don't want her to feel as if we don't trust her and depend on her. But from now on, I'm going to count the basket with her, and then I'll fill out the deposit slip and I'll go to the bank with her so that everything runs smoothly." And she said, "But we don't want her to think that we're not counting on her, because she so needs to feel needed and to feel like she's contributing, that we don't ever want to take this away from her, but we're going to have to supervise it just in case you hear anything." So, and that was heartbreaking. And it was not long after that that Sister Carolyn also told us that my mother's job as the church librarian was also being undermined by her increasing forgetfulness and confusion. And she was miss she wasn't shelving the Dewey Decimal System kind of defeated her, and she couldn't shelve the books the way that
Well,
so
she's
Carolyn.
not alone in that, by the way.
No, I couldn't find the book today in a library if I had to without Google. But she had to kind of that had to be taken over, but in such a way that we weren't making her feel that she was inadequate. And all that time, it had run in Alzheimer's runs in my family on my mother's side, and both of her sisters had died in memory care, along with her father, and one of her three brothers also suffered symptoms. So she must have seen this coming and wondered what would happen to her. It must have been terrifying on some level, but she was such a strong and a woman who would never complain about what she was going through, let alone admit it to anyone else, that it really we had to like have the courage to step in. And that was hard, to give her care we knew she needed and yet was difficult for her to accept. So the dance that went on, where we were just trying to help out rather than we're keeping an eye on you because we're afraid you're going to hurt yourself or get into some trouble, it was just when those roles reverse, when you as a child become the caregiver to the parent who has always cared for you for decades and decades of your life, it's a very difficult transition. And I had great trouble with it at first.
Well, you recounted this well in the book, and I also saw I was really quite moved at the beginning when you opened it up and you were questioning your own forgetfulness. Is this what's laying ahead for me? Is this what's waiting around the corner for me? Because it runs in your family and it's a couple things that you've forgotten, and you the self-doubt and the fear was gripping you. And I love how over the period of this book you were able to bring the reader and make peace with that, shake hands with that, the fact that, okay, whatever's around the corner, it's around the corner, but I'm going to live today. And I thought that was a beautiful thing. We'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. We're talking with Edward Grinnett. He is the editor-in-chief of Guidepost Magazine. His new book is called A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. And there's much more to come when we return. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver, hopeforthecaregiver.com. Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is the program for you as a family caregiver. HopeForTheCaregiver.com. I am continuing my conversation with Edward Grinnett, the author of the new book, A Journey of Faith, as he recounts caring for his mother through Alzheimer's. But it wasn't just Alzheimer's. This has been a part of his life for his entire life, the journey of a caregiver, plus his own wrestling with demons of addiction and alcoholism, and what led him to be the editor-in-chief now of one of the most beloved magazines in the world. And I, Edward, I wanted to address something. One of the things I've done on this program is connect the dots for people in relationships with alcoholics and addicts and identify them as caregivers, because addiction is a chronic disease. It's a chronic impairment. And if wherever there's a chronic impairment, there's a caregiver. And so those same principles apply. And as you walk through recovery, you've been in recovery for a very long time now. As you've walked through your own recovery through this, did you see the same principles of recovery applying to you as you journey with this through your, with your mother through Alzheimer's?
I did. And a part of the book covers the fact that I had been, I'd been sober for some time when my mother began exhibiting symptoms of dementia. And as I said, I was a long distance caregiver. So that sense of control almost, you know, was difficult because I was 650 miles away in New York and she was in Michigan. I had what they call in 12-step programs a slip during that period. And I slipped badly. I went back to drinking. And it turned my life upside down. It certainly didn't do me much good as a caregiver. And, you know, what I had to realize, and I didn't at the time. At the time, I said, well, I'm an alcoholic, and it's a chronic disease, and you have it whether you're sober or not sober. You still are an alcoholic. And you turn your life over to God in order to get through your sobriety a day at a time. And I refused to think about that my mother's condition and her need for care had affected me in a deep emotional way that triggered this new round of drinking. And I did see a counselor in a detox unit, and he kind of forced me to realize that, you know, I said, I don't need an excuse to drink. My brother's not drinking, my sister's not drinking, and they're dealing with my mother's condition. So why, I don't have that excuse. But he took me through it. He said, yes, you do, because these changes in your life all of a sudden are triggers. This fact that your mother needs care and she's not going to be there to care for you are triggers for emotional responses that, that, you know, in some people can trigger an addiction, and other people can trigger anxiety. And I finally came to grips with the fact that this situation with my mother and the need for caregiving to be there for her were what triggered this episode of addiction again. And I, you know, thank God I did go back to the meetings that I had got me sober in the first place. And I've been sober ever since. And that's been about 27 years. So I'm terribly grateful for that. But for me, I look back on it and see, you know, my mother's sudden need for this huge amount of care really turned my life upside down in a way that I wasn't even willing to admit and realize at the time. And I think a lot of caregivers go through, and they may not be alcoholics or addicts, but they go through a period of real stress and anxiety and fear more than anything when a loved one is suffering like that. And
well, we're going to medicate with something.
Right.
That's just the human condition. And whether it's this illusion of control or whatever it is that we got to do, sex, drugs, alcohol, we're going to medicate with something. It's very painful. And we're going to do this until we bend the knee and say, you know what? I can't do this.
I surrender.
You know, I surrender.
The part that I did find out was, you know, and I'm sure you've talked about this on your show, self-care for the caregiver, taking care of yourself. You know, I did realize that there were things I needed to do for myself, give myself permission to do as a caregiver or as a family member of someone who needs such care. You know, it was okay to take a vacation, for instance. I wasn't turning my back on my mother if I got to, you know, go on a nice trip somewhere. You know, there were times when I needed to disconnect when I could, not to abandon my mother in any way, but, you know, I had my brother and sister and sister-in-law to help out too. And there were ways that we eventually were able to make sure that we could all get a break. You know, and we pick up for each other when someone was on a break, on a vacation or a retreat. But so you learn to take care. You know, what I learned interestingly enough, in this caregiving situation with my mother, I learned how to take care of myself better than I ever had. After I got through that addiction slip, I really learned how to take care of myself because I knew that I had to be there for my mother, and the only way I could do that was to keep myself healthy. My late wife used to call it the oxygen masks syndrome. That, in the air on an airplane, when they read you the safety regulations, they tell you, make sure to put your oxygen mask on first before you try to help anyone else. And
I
that's
call that the
really
Delta
true. And
Doctrine. I heard that on
yes,
Delta years
it's
ago.
really true.
Called it the Delta Doctrine.
Yes, it's absolutely true in life. You have to take care of yourself before you can take care of somebody else. And you have to love yourself in a way that you can then give that love to another person and reap the rewards of it. Even in the end, I was so grateful to be there for my mom. And I started this journey not knowing for sure whether I could do that. And of course, I didn't do it on my own. I did it with the strength of a higher power and friends and families. There's a Franciscan church right down the street from my apartment in Manhattan. And I used to walk my dogs by that for those Franciscans. And they'd often be out in the front steps and they'd always come out and bless my dogs, which was for me, just incredible that they would come and say a prayer over my Labrador Retriever or my Cocker Spaniel. But I began to talk to them too, just a few minutes every day. And they'd just say, "How are you?" And I'd tell them, and they said, "Well, you're doing everything you can. And that's all you can do. And God will give you the strength to carry on." And hearing that every day was wonderful, and it helped. Everything helps.
Well, and we've got to hear that every day. That is the whole premise of everything I do here, is just that healthy caregivers make better caregivers. And
Yes.
I want to switch gears into the book for a moment. One of the stories in the book that you connected me to, it was about Patty and her father. And I mean, I teared up with this. And because I have a lot of callers to this program that I've dealt with, and people that I've talked to who are in this situation where they had an abusive father growing up, and then the father declines significantly, and then they're put in that role of caregiver, and yet they have serious unresolved issues, and yet here they are. And so, talk a little bit about Patty in that story. It was a beautiful story.
It is a beautiful story, and I've told it a lot. Patty was in a, I wasn't in a situation like Patty's, but I understood that so many people are. I have friends are, and Patty was a woman who grew up with a very stern and angry father, whose capacity to express love and to give love was severely limited. He was a Marine officer. She said she knew how to sing the Marine hymn before she knew how to sing Happy Birthday. And you better sing it out loud, and you better do it the way he wanted you to do it, or else you'd hear from it. So she was raised by a drill sergeant, and she ran away from that house as soon as she turned 18, and as soon as she left her mother, divorced this angry, stern man. And it could have stayed like that for decades, and it did. And Patty went out and she married a man the opposite of her father, who was kind and loving and supportive, and she had children. But she gets a call one day out of the blue from a man who runs his trailer park in Southern California, sort of out in the desert. And he says, "Are you Patty?" And I won't give the last name, but and she said, "Yes." Well, she said, "Your father's here, and I think you better come see him." And she just froze. She had cut him off and cut her feelings off from that man decades before. And, she finally goes out to the trailer park. Her father is well into dementia at that point, and he can't take care of himself. He's living in a rat trap of a trailer with just chaos. But they had the trailer manager had found Patty's name somewhere in his things, going through trying to figure out who to call. And Patty eventually has to bring him home. He's been di he, di he is diagnosed at the VA hospital as having Alzheimer's, and they send him home, and she asks God. She says, "How can I love someone who didn't love me? And now you're asking me to love this man." And the journey she goes on from that point as she tries to get close to him. And the Alzheimer's began to pull away at all his defenses. And she learned about his childhood that he never talked about, learned how tough he had had it, learned how frightened he was, and how he had put on this armor all his life to protect himself from his own feelings and from other people's feelings. He was scared of feelings. And in the end, finally, he says that one thing that he had never said to her. One of the last things he said to her, he said, "Patty, I love you. You're my daughter, and I love you." And the walls that were broken down by that moment were just staggering. And in my life, the last words that my mother spoke to me, the last word was love. And she hadn't spoken at all for a long time. And I was telling her what I was at her bedside, and I knew it was the very end, and there was not much more we could do for her. And the real caregiving had been taken over by the people at the memory care unit where she was. And I was sort of confessing to her, which I felt bad about, but I was saying how I was sorry for all the years that I was not necessarily a good son, and that I knew she had loved me for all those years, no matter what. And that last word she said to me was just the word love. And my
Wow.
mother died shortly after that. So, and you know, what I discover in my journey in the book is that there are two things that even a disease like Alzheimer's, and I would say other diseases as well, two things that can't destroy. And they're really two, they're one of the same thing, and that's love and that's faith. They exist outside of us in a way that a disease like Alzheimer's cannot destroy. And what was left with my mother was her faith and her love.
Beautiful story, Edward. We're talking with Edward Grinnan. His new book is called A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver. Don't go away. We've got more to go. We'll be right back.
You don't have to worry, and don't you be afraid. Joy comes in the morning. Troubles, they don't last always. For there's a friend named Jesus who will wipe your tears.
Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberg. That is Gracie again. We're glad to have you with us. We're continuing our conversation with Edward Grinnan. He's the author of the new book, A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. I was reading this book, and there was a scene, Edward, that was so poignant, and I immediately just found myself reliving a scene similar to that. I used to work at a place many, many years ago when I first got married, and there was a customer that would come in, and here I was a caregiver, I was in my 20s, and this guy came in, and he was in his late 60s, and he drove a blue Cadillac. I can still see it today. And he would get the wheelchair out for his wife, and he would take her everywhere. She had Alzheimer's. And this is back in the 80s. And I watched him caring for her, and she had mobility impairments as well. And I immediately thought, is that my life? Is that where I'm going with this? And here I was in my 20s, and here I am now in my 60s. And yeah, that is my life. And it's not a bad life. It's just a challenging life. And when I read your book, I was looking at the scene at Howard Johnson's when you were working there as a young man and you saw that couple. And I want you to talk about that, because that it hit me and it took me immediately back seeing that couple for me, what it did for me. But it did something for you when you saw that couple. And I'd like for you to talk about that a minute.
You know, I was a teenager, and I got a job being a busboy at our little corner, Hojo's. And I knew a lot of the people there, and my mother and the ladies from church would always have breakfast there. So, you know, it was sort of almost like family. But there was one group of senior citizens who used to come in on a regular basis. And there was a man, and he was always very well dressed. And he would bring his wife in, and she was always impeccably made up and impeccably her hair. Everything was perfect. She was beautiful. I mean, maybe way overdressed for Howard Johnson's. And I would watch him, and I didn't. I was a teenager.
I need to say something to my audience here. For those of you who don't know, Howard Johnson's is an upscale Waffle House. That's an, for and those of you don't know, remember Howard Johnson's, that's an upscale Waffle House.
So it, you know, so it was a great, community place. So he'd bring his wife in every day, and I observed them as a naive, self-centered 15-year-old. I noticed how much he did for her. Yeah, and she must have had some impairment in her eyesight, because he would always say, "Okay, you know, the butter is at 6 o'clock, and your tea is at 4 o'clock," and you know, and I noticed that she would argue with him occasionally, not bitterly in any way, but he would suggest, you know, "Would you like your oatmeal?" And she said, "I don't like oatmeal." And he'd say, "Well, you've had oatmeal like every day of your life since I've known you." And I suddenly realized, you know, not only was she somehow impaired and he was trying to make her life as normal and as livable as possible, but that when I looked at her with her makeup and her perfect hair and her beautiful clothes and how well put together she was, I realized that he did all that. I thought, how did she, if she's so confused and she doesn't know where things are and she forgets everything, and it's because he was taking care of her. And that left me with such, I hadn't known anything like that before. And I thought, he gets up at dawn every morning and gets her ready to go out and have a nice breakfast at Howard Johnson's. And he doesn't have to do that. He could, but it's meaningful to him to give meaning to her life, even as that meaning was slipping away from her. What I thought about years later, when my mother had dementia and I knew that the end was coming, you know, I suddenly remembered that man in Howard Johnson's. And I thought, what happened to him after she died, after she went on? And that's a great dilemma for caregivers, really. When you've, you know, devoted so much of yourself to the care of another human being that you love, and you've poured all that love and carried that burden of love through your loved one's illness or whatever, you know, or whatever injuries, there's a terrible void left when, you know, and it's not one, I mean, maybe you feel relief from the daily grind of it, but there's something about what you've been giving and giving and giving, and now there's no place to put that giving. And I've talked to caregivers in putting together the book who really struggled with that, who had to get past it, because it's not only the grief that they deal with, but it's the loss of purpose, because your purpose has become, you know, lifting up and caring for this other person. So it, you know, I give some tips in the book about, you know, what you should do, and that's if you are in that situation, and certainly reaching out to other people, because caregivers will often lose, you know, they put everything on hold sometimes, you know, their friendships, their social activities, a lot of the things that filled their life before caregiving did, they have to get back, and they have to be intentional about it, or they will get sort of trapped in this strange void, this emotional and spiritual void that can afflict a caregiver whose caregiving has come to the end.
One of the things I've tried to do on this program is to help caregivers push back of what I call the three I's. We lose our independence, we become isolated, and we lose our identity. And we stop speaking in first person singular often. And so I always ask caregivers that call into my program, how are you feeling? And that's where the stammering, and that's when the tears come, because they're not used to speaking from their own voice. And that's part of it, is how do we regain ourselves? How do we not get lost in someone else's story and have those moments? And it's been a lifetime battle for me.
And as I said, we are becoming a nation of caregivers. So this is something that's only going to grow. The brain diseases like dementia and Parkinson's, as the population gets older, those conditions are more and more prevalent, which means the caregiving must be more and more prevalent. And yes, there's a division between what you can do for your loved one at home and ultimately what might have to be done for them in a care unit. But still, the amount of caregiving that the country is called upon to provide for the people who need it is becoming larger and larger. And we don't want it to overwhelm us. On the other hand, the act of caring for someone you love and helping them when they can't always help themselves, you grow as a person, I think. No matter how painful and anxious caregiving can be, I think it helps you grow as a person. In my life, I haven't grown much when I was happy and content. You know, I found spiritual growth and emotional growth in the difficult times, in the challenging times when I was challenging myself or God was challenging me to be more of a person than I thought I could be. And caregiving, I think, brings a lot of that out in us. But it does teach us empathy and love in ways that we could not have been taught those things without it. Or at least in my case. And I
share that with you, Edward. I really do. And I'm a better pianist. I'm a better writer. I have more clarity of thought because of this journey, because it's forced me to deal with hard realities. I wrote a piece that's in one of your publications, Strength and Grace. I don't know when it'll be out. And I've tried to do some more of that, but I've been busy with some other writing and caregiving. And so hopefully I could do some more. But there's one that I think that's going to touch you. I think this is the piece that's going to be in the next issue. And that is, I was playing the piano. There's a woman in our church who, and I do the music down our little church here in the valley. And this man and his wife, and he's caring for his wife. She has dementia, and it's fairly pronounced at this point, but she's been a violinist for a very long time, a wonderful fiddle player that she's traveled all over, and she's just very, very, very talented. And she'll just kind of look off into space. But I told her to bring the violin to church, and I said, don't worry, I'll handle the heavy lifting on the music part. Just let her play. And she was playing one Sunday, and this is the story I put in Strength and Grace. She was playing The Old Rugged Cross, and she's looking off into space while she's playing it from memory. And her playing was beautiful. It was just flawless. I stopped playing and let her just play it a cappella. And the whole church was just, you could tell they were all holding their breath listening to it. It just reverberated around the church. It was one of the most beautiful performances of the hymn I've ever heard. And they all knew that she was struggling with dementia. She didn't, you know, and yet her music was still there. And I just saw the tears in her husband's eyes, just filling his eyes. He had such pride and was able to hear his wife play. And I thought about just the power of music, what it does, how it does so much in those moments, but also how important it was for that church to experience that. That we're not going to shuffle this off like the priest tried to do with your brother. No, we're gonna embrace where they are, and that's so important. In our last moment, close us up in the last 30 seconds. Close us up with your heart on this.
I heard what you said about music, and I have stories about that because music sometimes remains. My mother could sing hymns long after she lost the ability to speak. But what I think caregiving taught me more than anything, and I want people to hear this and it might be helpful, is that it taught me to be present in the moment. You know, when you're caregiving, you have to be there with that person, and particularly with Alzheimer's, because they're often only in the moment. And when my mother would go off and say she had conversation with people I knew who were dead, instead of trying to fight that, I would always say, yeah, well, what did you talk about? Why did you want to talk to that person? How did that help you? And I just went with it. And sometimes that's the best we can do, is just go with it. Let us be led where we're going to be led, and not try to fight it and not try to control everything except those things that we can control.
That is a great way to end this conversation. Edward, I'm going to have you back on. This was just so powerful and meaningful, and I appreciate very much you taking the time. Edward Grinnan, the author of the new book, A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers, available wherever books are sold, and certainly out at Guidepost.
Shopguidepost.org.
Shopguidepost.org. Shopguidepost.org. Please, this book will have you in tears, and you will love this book. It will touch your heart in a very profound way. It did mine. And so I thank you, Edward, for being a part of this. This is Peter Rosenberger. Well, this is Hope for the Caregiver. We'll see you next time. You've heard me talk about Standing with Hope over the years. This is the prosthetic limb ministry that Gracie envisioned after losing both of her legs. Part of that outreach is our prosthetic limb recycling program. Did you know that prosthetic limbs can be recycled? No kidding. There is a correctional facility in Arizona that helps us recycle prosthetic limbs. And this facility is run by a group out of Nashville called Core Civic. And we met them over 11 years ago. And they stepped in to help us with this recycling program. of taking prostheses and you disassemble them. You take the knee, the foot, the pylon, the tube clamps, the adapters, the screws, the liners, the prosthetic socks, all these things we can reuse, and inmates help us do it. Before CoreCivic came along, I was sitting on the floor at our house or out in the garage when we lived in Nashville, and I had tools everywhere, limbs everywhere, and feet, boxes of them, and so forth. And I was doing all this myself, and I'd make the kids help me. And it got to be too much for me. And so I was very grateful that CoreCivic stepped up and said, look, we are always looking for faith-based programs that are interesting and that give inmates a sense of satisfaction. And we'd love to be a part of this. And that's what they're doing. And you can see more about that at standingwithhope.com/recycle. So please help us get the word out that we do recycle prosthetic limbs. We do arms as well, but the majority of amputations are lower limb, and that's where the focus of Standing with Hope is. That's where Gracie's life is, with her lower limb prostheses. And she's used some of her own limbs in this outreach that she's recycled. I mean, she's been an amputee for over 30 years. So you go through a lot of legs and parts and other types of materials, and you can reuse prosthetic socks and liners if they're in good shape. All of this helps give the gift that keeps on walking, and it goes to this prison in Arizona where it's such an extraordinary ministry. Think about that. Inmates volunteering for this. They want to do it, and they've had amazing times with it, and I've had very moving conversation with the inmates that work in this program. And you can see, again, all of that at standingwithhope.com/recycle. They're putting together a big shipment right now for us to ship over. We do this pretty regularly throughout the year as inventory rises, and they need it badly in Ghana. So please go out to standingwithhope.com/recycle and get the word out and help us do more. If you want to offset some of the shipping, you can always go to the giving page and be a part of what we're doing there. We're purchasing material in Ghana that they have to use that can't be recycled. We're shipping over stuff that can be, and we're doing all of this to lift others up and to point them to Christ. And that's the whole purpose of everything that we do. And that is why Gracie and I continue to be Standing with Hope. Standingwithhope.com. Take my hand.